This hour's top stories: Turkey reportedly evacuates 7 military observation posts in northwest Syria, withdrawing its troops from territory controlled by the Syrian government. At least 15 civilians are killed after an explosion rips through a city in central Afghanistan. The Pentagon calls China the most pressing long-term strategic threat, saying U.S. warships will be more assertive in response to Beijing's actions. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Our top story: Turkey has evacuated 7 military observation posts in northwest Syria. That's according to a Reuters report citing the Turkish source. The report says Turkey has pulled back its troops from territory controlled by the Syrian government to areas held by militants. According to the report, the evacuations began in October and were completed late on Thursday. The Turkish source has said that the move is not in the form of troop withdrawal or reducing their numbers. It's just about changing location. Now, Ankara set up a dozen military posts in northwest of Syria back in 2018. The move was part of a deal Turkey clinched with Russia and Iran to calm fighting between the Syrian government and militants. An explosion in Afghanistan's Ghazni province leaves at least 15 civilians dead and 20 more wounded. Media have cited an Interior Ministry spokesman as saying the explosives planted on a motorbike ripped through a religious gathering in Gelan district. No group or individual has yet claimed responsibility, but a Taliban militant group has carried out such attacks in the past. Violence has seen an upward trend in Afghanistan over the past few weeks. That despite the government of the Taliban that are engaging in talks to hammer out a lasting peace deal. Earlier, our Kabul correspondent Amin Alami joined us with the details on the deadly blast in Afghanistan's Ghazni province.
Well, this incident happened in Gilan district of southern Ghazni province of Afghanistan. Based on Islamic and, of course, Afghan traditions, most Afghans come together during the Fridays to attend the reciting program of the Holy Quran. And this incident also happened in one such gathering in Gilan district of Ghazni province in southern Afghanistan. According to officials here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, mainly Afghanistan, Interior Ministry spokesperson Tariq Aryan, at least 15 civilians, including children, were killed and at least 20 others were wounded as a result of this bomb explosion in Gilan district of Ghazni province. Despite the Afghan government officials blame the Taliban militant group for launching this attack and killing innocent civilians, including innocent children, but none of terrorist groups, including the Taliban militants, has not claimed responsibility for this incident so far.
An Afghan Taliban delegation led by its political chief visits Pakistan to discuss peace efforts. The visit comes as there is a 20-day break in the intra-Afghan dialogue, which has so far made little headway on the future of Afghanistan. Kamran Youssef explains.
The Afghan Taliban delegation is in Pakistan to discuss the peace efforts. The delegation is headed by Mullah Brother, the head of Taliban's political office in Doha. The visit comes after Taliban and Afghan government took a 20-day break in their talks taking place in Doha. After months of negotiations, the two sides recently agreed on the rules of engagement. But there is no progress on the comprehensive ceasefire as Taliban have linked the truce with peace deal. But the Pakistan's foreign minister, who also met the Taliban leaders, said Taliban have shown their readiness to seek an end to the war.
Taliban is baat par kail ho chuke hain.
Taliban are convinced that the continuation of war is neither in their interest nor in the interest of Afghanistan. I get the feeling after my negotiations with the Taliban that they are serious to end this conflict, which is very encouraging.
Afghan Taliban and the U.S. signed a landmark deal in February this year. The deal outlines a roadmap for the U.S. troops' withdrawal from Afghanistan. In return, Taliban agreed not to allow Afghan soil to be used again by terrorist groups. Given Pakistan's historic ties with the Taliban, the U.S. and Afghan government expect Islamabad to ensure that the Taliban live up to their commitment.
Pakistan is in a position to use its lever, but it will not, I think. It will just facilitate. It will try, as Foreign Minister Qureshi has said in this event, that Pakistan will try to let the Afghan. There will be no imposition of any process on Afghan.
At the moment, all eyes are on the incoming U.S. president as to whether he will follow the same policy on Afghanistan or take a different course.
On paper, there seems no change in the policy of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden with regard to Afghanistan, but he may not hasten the troops' withdrawal as sought by President Trump. This means the situation in Afghanistan will remain uncertain, at least in the foreseeable future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations says his country is committed to bringing about peace, stability, and development in Afghanistan.
Iran and Afghanistan enjoy common religious, cultural, linguistic, and historical backgrounds, and our stability, social, cultural development, and economic growth are intertwined and mutually reinforced.
Takht-e Ravanchi was speaking at a Security Council meeting on Afghanistan. He said that decades-long insecurity there can end only through a comprehensive and inclusive peace process, the Iranian envoy said. Afghanistan's neighbors, as well as regional and international partners, should support the peace process too. The process, actually. Takht-e Ravanchi called on Taliban militants to halt their attacks in order for the peace process to go ahead. He also said the presence of foreign forces is one of the sources of instability in Afghanistan. Iran has slammed a human rights resolution adopted by the United Nations General Assembly. In the next report, we will see why Iran says the resolution has nothing to do with protecting human rights.
The issue of human rights once again caused controversy and deep divisions at the United Nations General Assembly this week. The Assembly passed a resolution on the human rights situation in Iran on Wednesday. The document was critical of the use of death penalty and prison conditions, among other alleged rights violations in Iran. The resolution was proposed by the Canadian government and supported by the United States and mostly its regional and Western allies. The UN General Assembly has 193 members, but the resolution against Iran was passed with 82 votes in favor. That's significantly less than half of the number of member states. The Iranian government was quick to condemn the move, saying an anti-Iran bloc used the General Assembly on Wednesday as a tool to impose pressure on Iran. Tehran argues that the resolution has exposed sheer hypocrisy regarding human rights because many of the proponents of the anti-Iran move have either notorious records of human rights violations or choose to remain silent on such violations in some parts of the world. Tehran said the states behind the resolution are under the influence of American bullying. The Iranian government says those states have turned a blind eye to U.S. economic terrorism against the Iranians at the time of a worsening pandemic, that are acting as Washington's accomplices instead of condemning its illegal and inhumane sanctions that have hurt ordinary Iranians.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says Canada and other supporters of the anti-Iran move at the UN must immediately stop their meddlesome approach. He said the resolution is an outrageous example of abusing transcendent concepts to advance political motives. Now, double standards regarding human rights were further exposed this week at the UN General Assembly when the U.S. voted many, or its allies actually abstained from voting on a resolution on combating neo-Nazism. Contemporary forms of racism, critics say such approach leaves no room for any doubt that international organizations are being used by certain states for political purposes.
This week, the United States voted against, while European states and Canada abstained from voting on an important Russia-drafted document. The initiative was titled Combating Glorification of Nazism, Neo-Nazism, and Other Practices that Contribute to Fueling Contemporary Forms of Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. The Russian draft of resolution was passed with 130 votes in favor, despite the campaign by the U.S. and its allies. The Russian initiative is aimed at condemning and combating some of the most notorious forms of violation of human rights in the world, like Nazism and racism. So why did the U.S. and its allies choose to stand against or be different towards the resolution? Was it because the text was drafted by Russia, which is a rival on the world stage? Critics say what happened this week at the UN General Assembly further exposed double standards adopted by the U.S. and its allies regarding human rights around the world.
Ultimately, anything they do in the name of human rights always is underpinned with their own economic interests. And they don't make any bones about this. They will drop the principles of human rights when it comes to anything which threatens their economic interests. So this is a highly dubious moral position to take, given that you're finding these nations squawking the loudest about the supposed human rights violations in other nations.
Meanwhile, some of the states that are very loud in lecturing others at the UN are themselves known violators of human rights at home. An instance is Canada, which is widely criticized for its violations of the rights of its indigenous population and widespread discrimination against them. Meanwhile, Persian Gulf Arab allies of the United States are also among the states that join US-led campaigns against other countries over human rights. The Arab countries like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are ranked among the world's worst rights violators. Observers believe this trend needs to change if the U.S. and its allies really care about human rights around the world.
UN human rights experts have expressed deep concern over the lack of accountability for the killing of Palestinian children by Israeli forces in recent years. According to the UN experts, civil society organizations have documented the deaths of 155 Palestinian children since 2013. Those children were killed by Israeli forces using live ammunition or crowd-controlled weapons. UN experts said only three indictments on criminal charges had been issued for offenses directly tied to those killings. They also referred to the killing of a Palestinian teenager in the occupied West Bank earlier this month. The UN experts called the murder a grave violation of international law and urged an independent investigation. The teenager was shot by an Israeli soldier during a protest against a settlement outpost. He later died of his wounds. To other news now, China has urged the U.S. to stop what it called the unjustified crackdown on Chinese companies. China says it'll continue to take necessary measures to ensure its companies' legitimate rights and interests. A reaction followed a Reuters report that Washington is poised to add dozens of Chinese companies to a trade blacklist. The report, citing two people familiar with the matter, said the companies include China's top chip maker, SMIC. The news agency said companies that the U.S. accuses of having ties with the Chinese military are on the list as well. The administration of President Donald Trump has prepared a so-called entity list that hits key Chinese industries. The U.S. military says its warships will be more assertive in response to what it calls violations of international law. The Pentagon made the announcement in a document setting objectives for the U.S. Navy for the coming years. The document mentions several countries, particularly China and Russia. It accuses them of growing aggressiveness and contesting the balance of power in key regions. The document also describes China as the most pressing long-term strategic threat. The Pentagon says in response to that it will accept more calculated tactical risks. The U.S. and China are at odds over Beijing's territorial claim of all the islands in the South China Sea. Beijing accuses Washington of interfering in that region. Political analyst Ting Douxu says the United States sees itself as the guardian of international law.
The U.S. speaks like, you know, it is the guardian of the law. It dictates the behaviors of other countries. And secondly, you mentioned about this big picture, the China-U.S. competition. China does not see the U.S. as a competitor, does not see the U.S. as a threat. But the U.S., because it wants to continue its predominant position around the global, it sees the rise of China, the development of China, the peaceful growth of Chinese economy as a threat, as a potential replacement of the U.S. position. So you can see U.S. is basically increasing the pressure on China, increasing the attacks on China in different fields, including trade, including the military, including technology. That's why they are attacking Huawei, they are attacking the Chinese companies, they are creating a lot of instability and troubles in the South China Sea. Remember, South China Sea disputes is about China, about Vietnam, about the Philippines, about Malaysia, the regional countries. It has nothing to do with the United States. Why the U.S., from thousands of miles away, is involved in such a case?
Well, as I told you earlier, U.N. human rights experts have expressed deep concern over the lack of accountability for the killing of Palestinian children that is done at the hands of the Israeli forces in recent years. To discuss that a little bit further, I'm going to bring in His Excellency Richard Falk, Chair of Global Law at Queen Mary University of London, as well as you know, former UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory. Sir, it's very good to have you with us. I'd like to begin with your understanding and perhaps, you know, the importance of this ever-occurring reports and worries expressed by UN human rights elements.
I think it is a issue that deserves world attention, because it seems on several fronts, including the treatment of children, not only these recent reports of IDF incidents in which Palestinian children have been inexcusably killed, but also the treatment in Israeli prisons. And it's part, I think, of a Israeli accelerated effort to take advantage of the last days of the Trump presidency to do things that they would be more hesitant to do in a Biden, at least the early period of a Biden presidency. So I think what has been happening is a very opportunistic kind of violation of international humanitarian law at its most basic level, and in a way that offends moral sensibilities, because it's victimizing innocent children. And it is to be understood, though, in relation to efforts to greatly expand the settlements, unlawful as they are, even to give legitimacy to the so-called Israeli outposts that are distributed throughout the West Bank and are flagrant violations of international humanitarian law, especially the Fourth Geneva Convention. So all of these developments are part, I think, of this Israeli policy to take advantage of the last days of Trump's presidency.
Thank you very much, Your Excellency. I'm just quickly running out of time. Really appreciate it. It was an advantage to speak to you, Sir Richard Falk, former UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory out of Yalıkavak, Turkey. I really appreciate your time, and that's the end of this bulletin.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Joe Biden was in Georgia on Tuesday, 15th of December, campaigning for the Democrats in crucial Senate runoff elections, yesterday after addressing the American public for the first time as its official president-elect. In Washington, Mitch McConnell finally acknowledged Joe Biden's victory over Donald Trump, who continues to make baseless claims of electoral fraud and refused to concede. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Miranda Bryant, Lauren Gambino, and David Smith. The piece is titled, Biden Campaigns for Georgia Senate Democrats Following Electoral College Victory. Joe Biden was in Georgia on Tuesday, 15th of December, campaigning for the Democrats in crucial Senate runoff elections, just a day after addressing the American public for the first time as its official president-elect. In Washington, Mitch McConnell finally acknowledged Joe Biden's victory over Donald Trump, who continues to make baseless claims of electoral fraud and refuses to concede. Today, I want to congratulate President-elect Joe Biden, the Republican majority leader in the Senate said on the Senate floor, adding, in reference to the California Senator Kamala Harris, all Americans can take pride that our nation has a female vice president-elect for the very first time. The White House, however, still refuses to recognize Donald Trump's defeat. Asked about Mitch McConnell's concession, which came after Electoral College proceedings on Monday, 14th of December, White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany replied, the president is still involved in ongoing litigation related to the election. Yesterday's vote was one step in the constitutional process. McEnany said she did not have a reaction to McConnell's decision to congratulate Biden. She said, the president again is pursuing ongoing litigation. I would refer you to the campaign for further comments. Asked by The Guardian if Donald Trump intended to run for election again in 2024. The White House press secretary merely noted that legal action continued. She denied that such efforts were damaging U.S. democracy, insisting, without evidence, that the Russia investigation into Donald Trump caused greater harm. Now the Electoral College has voted, Donald Trump's hopes of overturning the result vanishingly faint anyway, after more than 50 defeats in the courts of law, are totally extinguished. Joe Biden will be inaugurated in Washington on 20th of January. The first Democrat to win Georgia since 1992, Biden appeared in Atlanta, Georgia for a drive-in rally in support of John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, who faced Republican senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler in 5th of January contest that will decide control of the Senate and with it the legislative power of Biden's administration. "It's starting to feel like I won Georgia three times," Biden said, referring to the multiple recounts that affirmed his victory after the Trump campaign challenged the results. Biden said Georgians had refused to be bullied or silenced. The trip to Atlanta, Georgia was Biden's first on the campaign trail since the election on 3rd of November. The drive-in rally meant to boost Democrat turnout in multi-million dollar contests in which early voting has already begun featured both Senate candidates, as well as the former Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams and the mayor of Atlanta, Georgia, Keisha Lance Bottoms. Joe Biden said John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock are running on to represent Georgia. "Georgia, they'll actually fight for you, represent you, and stand up for you." Before Biden's appearance, it emerged he had tapped Pete Buttigieg, his rival for the 2020 Democratic nomination, to lead the Department of Transportation. The news was first reported by Reuters news agency. No Biden transition official or Buttigieg representative has publicly confirmed the report. On Monday night, 14th of December, Joe Biden addressed the nation in a primetime speech to mark the Electoral College verdict, almost 6 weeks after Election Day. Speaking from Wilmington, Delaware, Biden declared that the rule of law, our Constitution, and the will of the people have prevailed. Our democracy, pushed, tested, and threatened, proved to be resilient. The man who will become the 46th president said it was time to turn the page on an election which he proclaimed one of the most amazing demonstrations of civic duty we've ever seen in our country. The final Electoral College result of 306 to 232 was, he noted, the same as when Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton in 2016. At that time, Biden said, President Trump called the Electoral College tally a landslide. In a 13-minute speech interrupted several times by coughing and throat clearing, Joe Biden attacked both Trump's attempts to overturn the result in the form of multiple recounts and legal challenges and unconscionable threats and abuse to which election workers and officials were subjected. They were heard by more than 80 judges across the country, Biden said, and in every case, no cause or evidence was found to reverse or to question or to dispute the results. Citing a Texas lawsuit rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court, Biden said, "It's a position so extreme we've never seen it before, a position that refused to respect the will of the people, refused to respect the rule of law, and refused to honor our Constitution." Joe Biden, however, also sought to bring together a bitterly divided nation, saying it was time to turn the page, as we've done throughout our history, to unite and to heal. Meanwhile, Donald Trump shows little sign of even uniting his own party. On Tuesday, 15th of December, he retweeted a message from a conservative lawyer which said the governor and secretary of Georgia should be sent to jail. The post included a doctored image of Brian Kemp and Brad Raffensperger wearing face masks featuring the Chinese flag. The officials resisted verbal attacks from Trump, who demanded they reject the result of their state's election, even though multiple recounts affirmed Joe Biden's victory. Biden also addressed the U.S. death toll in the coronavirus pandemic, which has now reached 300,000. "My heart goes out to each and every one of you in this dark winter of the pandemic," he said, "about to spend the holidays and the new year with a black hole in your hearts." On Tuesday, Mitch McConnell offered a faint echo of that appeal. "Our nation needs us to add another bipartisan chapter to this record of achievement." The Senate Majority Leader appeared to be hinting at the need for a deal on coronavirus relief package that has eluded Capitol Hill for months. Mitch McConnell and other top congressional leaders, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer and House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy met multiple times on Tuesday, 15th of December, in an effort to end a months-long standoff over coronavirus relief and finalize a funding bill in time to avert a government shutdown at the weekend, although it remained unclear if a deal would be reached. "Now we are continuing to work. I think there is progress," McCarthy said as he left the earlier gathering late on Tuesday afternoon. Joe Biden told reporters he had spoken to Mitch McConnell, a notoriously ruthless partisan operator. "While we disagree on a lot of things, there are things we can work together on," Biden said. "We agreed to get together sooner rather than later." Elsewhere, Dr. Anthony Fauci, America's top infectious disease expert, said Biden and Kamala Harris should be vaccinated as soon as we possibly can. Dr. Anthony Fauci told ABC News, "For security reasons, I really feel strongly that we should get them vaccinated as soon as we possibly can. You want Biden fully protected as he enters into the presidency in January."
Internet trolls. The Internet. What began as an exclusive tool to connect militaries, governments, and then universities has now, more than 60 years later, transformed everything about how modern societies operate and communicate. Today, no one can escape the grasp of social media or evade the mind-boggling connectivity that nearly all humans worldwide now have access to. But few have been prepared for what has also emerged with all this human connectedness. A new and ominous strain of human behavior has been unleashed. Increasingly, people are hiding behind a cloak of anonymity, waiting to provoke, harass, and even threaten anyone they choose. They are called internet trolls.
A troll is someone devoting large parts of their life to attacking other people on the internet, basically trying to make that other person's life miserable in some way.
They send things to my home. It terrifies me to think what they could do if they wanted to, knowing exactly where I live, knowing where my children go to school.
Trolls can be a minor annoyance or a life-crippling terror. But what happens if society tries to silence them? Who loses then?
Trolling is a free speech issue. And if you aren't free to hate someone, then you're not free.
I've been associated with all kinds of organized trolling groups. We're stretching the bounds of free speech. You either use it or you lose it. Feelings will be hurt.
Politicians and the courts are now grappling with who really is a dangerous troll.
I've been called trolled by very powerful people that should know better. Homophobe, misogynist, racist, all this stuff is just lazy people not wanting to interact.
Artist Gregory Allen Elliott is at the center of a landmark trolling case that might land him behind bars and forever change what any of us, anywhere, can or cannot say online.
If Mr. Elliott is convicted of a criminal offense, watch out. Nobody will be safe. You better shut up, because if you don't, you could be going to jail.
My
My name is Gina Crosley Corcoran. I write a blog called The Feminist Breeder, and I deal with a really steady onslaught of very vicious and dedicated trolls. Trolls can be really, really sneaky. When you think about patterns of stalking, stalkers don't just do it really quietly. They leave their victim clues that they're being stalked in order to scare them. So today I got a Working Person's Store magazine addressed to the Feminist Breeder with my home address. My trolls sent me this, probably to imply that I'm too lazy to find a real job besides blogging. So, guys, hey! Come here, pumpkin pie.
Gina's blog earns her family a decent income. She writes about being a stay-at-home mom, but from a pro-choice, modern feminist perspective. And a large, active community of like-minded women has grown around her blog.
I like to see that recognition response when someone else goes, oh, me too. And that's so validating. That's why I do it.
Feminists are frequently targeted by trolls. Gina knew to expect attacks, but she's been overwhelmed by the volume of abuse and stunned to discover who her trolls are.
The trolls and the really dangerous people that I attract are themselves mothers and have small children at home. They get something out of taking out their frustrations on someone like me. They see me as a figurehead, and they're really angry about the attention I'm getting from people, and they want to discredit me in any way they possibly can. These people spend all day taking screenshots of every word I type on the internet. They all pick it apart. They talk about my children. They talk about my clothes. They spend an incredible amount of energy focusing exclusively on something that they claim to completely hate. And to me, that's the difference between someone who just disagrees with you or someone who's really stalking every move you make. And those are the trolls.
Gina sees little difference between her trolls and a stalker. They want to see her react, and they know how to push her buttons.
A stalker wants to upset that person. They want to make them afraid. And that's what these trolls do. They leave comments in such a way that makes you feel afraid of what they're going to do and say. They'll leave comments about my address or my kids, and they do it because they want to get a reaction out of me. They want to see me lash out, and it all feeds into this sick and twisted entertainment value to them.
So what is it that motivates trolls? In London, England, psychologist Raj Persaud believes the internet has spawned an entirely new, yet unexplored, set of human behaviors.
Psychologists and psychiatrists have been somewhat taken back by the huge amount of negativity there appears to be on the internet. And it may be that the internet has unleashed a kind of dark demon within millions of people out there in the general public. We think that one of the things that's problematic about the internet is it normalizes extreme behavior. So because you see a lot of people on the internet behaving in an extreme fashion, you think it's more normal than it might actually be. And the other thing is it seems to encourage a herd-like piece of behavior. If one person starts being negative and a group of people pile in behind them, there's a kind of cascade effect, which you don't see in ordinary life outside of the internet.
Psychologists further believe that one thing has compounded the effects and numbers of trolls.
Anonymity seems to be a very important factor on the internet in that it seems to make people less inhibited about doing nasty things. It means that people feel free to get away with bad behavior because they think they're not going to get called to account. No one's going to point the finger at them. So the anonymity effect seems very important and may explain why so much dark and negative and extreme behavior occurs on the internet but doesn't seem to occur in real life, in face-to-face interaction.
But what inspires a troll? What do they get out of it? Operating out of an undisclosed location in North America, one hardcore and self-professed troll agreed to tell us, provided we maintained his anonymity.
I'm Wild Goose, and I'm a member of the Bill Wagoner crew, and I've done a podcast for the past several years documenting internet troll activity, hacker activity, Gamergate, Anonymous, Occupy, you name it. I've been a part of it. there's a serious darkness in not only us, but I think in everybody online. I think a lot of people just don't tap into the power of anonymity and what it can do for them. When you're anonymous, you're free to do and say a lot of things that you otherwise wouldn't do in real life. You would be powerless to do in real life.
Goose joined forces with like-minded trolls he met online, and they work as a team to offend and infuriate as many people as they can.
If you were to Google Bill Wagoner crew, chances are you'd come across a term called rip trolling. When somebody dies and their family puts up a memorial up in their honor, we might set up a separate page, or we might just go on that page and create a ruckus. But the idea is to get as many followers as possible on that page and make it seem as legit as possible so that we can offend as many people as possible when we start posting gore and other kinds of shocking material.
Hounding people when they are most vulnerable, like at the time of a loved one's funeral, is a surefire hit for the troll.
That's the easiest way for us to create a mass effect. It's really effective when you have all these people who are already emotional. They got this bomb on them, you know, with the gore photos, maybe some kind of sexually explicit photos. It sends their emotions into overdrive.
But what do the trolls get out of seeing these distraught reactions? Lulz. L-U-L-Z. That's the currency of the troll, and it's what they're after. Lulls are laughs, fun and amusement at the expense of others. The Wagoner crew will prod people online for reactions. The bigger their response, the more popular the target becomes.
Someone who gets really animated and waves their arms around on camera, preferably, or they'll scream into a microphone on a podcast, they might start crying, they become Lulz cow. They're like an ongoing target. We love that kind of reaction. We want to make them cry. We love to make them cry.
The open internet is a playground for goose and trolls like him. And the stark contrast to what they can get away with in normal society is not lost on them.
I really can't. I mean, the real world's so boring and it's lacking in lulls. It really is. I don't think we'd be able to find this in real life. The internet presented something that was never available to us before.
Today, if you go on the internet, you're entering the domain of the troll. But where did internet trolling all start? This unassuming computer science professor may hold the answer and may himself be one of the very first trolls on the internet.
I'm Dr. Adam Steele. I am an associate professor of computer science at DePaul University in Chicago. I think I'm the first recorded troll on the internet. Certainly not the first troll, but the first one that was actually written up. This is a piece that is here because my wife hates it, called The Alchemist. I hadn't really noticed, but it sure does look like a troll, and I guess he's stirring the pot.
Adam would first access the internet while attending university in the province of Quebec, Canada. And it wouldn't be long until he was stirring the pot with his wry sense of humor.
I was a grad student in 1993 at Concordia University in Montreal. Essentially, at that time, the internet was still very nascent, and at that point was just a relatively small number of universities that were connected together. And there was this kind of quasi-bulletin board system called the News Network. You had, for example, a group like Rec.Humor, and people would trade jokes, and I guess what happened at some point was that there were people on Rec.Humor who had a certain penchant for tasteless jokes that was not appreciated by the rest of the community. And so the tasteless denizens were kind of hived off and started their own group, and Alt.Tasteless was born.
As the chat group Alt.Tasteless got going, the jokes started to get more and more extreme. But soon, the jokes just couldn't get the rise they wanted.
I think it was a long, hot summer, and everybody was kind of getting a little bored. And there was this idea that the people of Alt.Tasteless should invade a news group, and somebody suggested Wreck.Pets.Cats.
Yes, cat lovers would be the next target, and Adam would be the lead.
Like any community, they wanted to discuss problems that their cats had. So I guess my contribution was that we should actually engage them by writing a story that would appear to be from somebody who was genuinely concerned, get them to respond, a stealth attack. So I created a fictitious identity, and it was posted anonymously to Wreck.Pets.Cats.
And what happened next would be recognized by Wired magazine as something that had never happened on the internet before.
I have two cats, Sootykin, 2-year-old female, and Chode. Chode's problem is that he has really stinky shits, paint peelers.
Adam's post was vulgar and over the top, but he took care to keep it believable.
Sooty goes into heat something fierce, yowling and presenting all the time. While dinner was cooking, I tried to stimulate her with a Q-tip because I had heard that one can induce ovulation that way. My date came into the bathroom while I was doing this, and needless to say, I don't think she bought my explanation.
The cat lovers, however, bought Adam's story, hook, line, and sinker.
The initial responses to the post were very helpful and essentially suggested that Sooty should get spayed. Then slowly, other suggestions started popping up.
As the off-color suggestions became grosser and more extreme, the cat lovers were outraged, and the Alt.Tasteless gang had a blast.
So what we did was we essentially trolled, you know, where you throw a lure out behind a boat and motor slowly over the fish until somebody bites.
Adam and the Alt.Tasteless crew had become the internet's first gang of trolls. Back then, Adam was one of about 14 million internet users worldwide. 25 years later, there are 3 billion people online, and the nature of trolling has evolved.
What's happened now is that trolling has taken on a meaning different from the sort of fishing metaphor and more towards that of the troll under the bridge, where someone will post something and the responses will be very destructive, basically laying waste to whatever's been said.
In the early 1990s, Adam and his friends were trolling for fun. But now, negativity is everywhere on the internet. Back in London, Dr. Raj Persaud suspects that we all have a potential troll lurking in our psyches.
The answer to the question of whether we're all potential trolls is delivered by a simple question. Have you ever gossiped negatively about someone else? Because if you have, it is a sense in which you are doing a kind of micro-trolling behavior.
It's not pretty, but science has now proven that putting someone else down can make us feel better about ourselves. And there's a specific name for the feeling that results.
Psychologists are taking increasing interest in what's called the Schadenfreude effect. And Schadenfreude is a word from German, which is about feeling pleasure at someone else's downfall. There are a lot of people on the planet feeling low self-esteem, feeling beaten up by life. Maybe watching other people do badly, watching other people suffer, seems to correct your low self-esteem.
Deriving pleasure from the pain of others is a characteristic we all seem to have to a degree. But psychologists are now finding that hardcore trolls are likely to express 4 dark personality traits. In Winnipeg, Canada, a landmark study of internet trolls has now shown that one of those dark traits stands above the rest. Sadism.
Sadists do it because they like it. Some people get their jollies by being rude and obnoxious and causing harm to other people, sometimes serious harm to other people, and it gives them pleasure.
Dr. Paul Trapnell and his colleagues have confirmed that the internet, with millions of potential victims and anonymity to hide behind, is a playground for people with sadistic tendencies.
It's a venue where a person can go on and ruffle somebody's feathers or embarrass or humiliate them or make them feel anguish, and there is no consequence to that, and it's easy to do. So that might attract people that take pleasure in harming people, and that seems to be what we found.
Trapnell and his team began their studies by focusing on people who frequently leave comments on message boards. A significant number of them unabashedly rated trolling as their favorite commenting activity.
Then we asked them to also fill out a number of personality questionnaires, and those questionnaires included some measures of well-known, widely studied forms of nasty tendencies. We found, as expected, that the trollers were higher on all of the malevolent traits. It's not a stretch, but nobody had investigated that with data. And so we did so, and sure enough, that's true. Let me illustrate what I mean by these four dark tendencies that have specially toxic social consequences. Psychopathy, we can be callously indifferent by our reckless pursuit of things that we want. In narcissism, we are callously indifferent to others by our pursuit of grandiosity and wanting to hog the limelight, wanting to think that we are superior to other people. Machiavellianism, the pursuit of strategic harm in order to benefit ourselves. Sadism is a particularly malevolent way that we can do harm to others, and that is by seeking to harm people purposely because it's pleasurable to us. So all of us have the potential to be dark in these four different ways. And indeed, some people combine these tendencies in ways that make them especially dark, malevolent individuals. And that is a very, very malevolent person. This is not somebody that you want to have anything to do with at all. Definitely not.
Nasty individuals have had free rein on the internet, and trolling is on the rise. But more and more people are starting to fight back. This accused troll has been forced off the internet for 3 years by a Toronto court. And today, his artwork has been forced off these cafe walls by angry protests. Gregory Allen Elliott is in limbo, awaiting verdict in a landmark Twitter harassment trial.
When I use Twitter, I use it as pure form. As an artist, I just went, this is a brush, this is some paint, this is a canvas. I used it to comment on politics. I used it to help people. But I just used it every way possible. One day, I responded to every tweet that came across my tweet stream. And then someone said, you don't have to respond to everything. And I said, I know, right? But today, that's what I'm doing as an artist and an experimenter.
At one point, Gregory was sending 300 tweets per day. He was acerbic, sometimes crude, and very opinionated. Inevitably, he made some enemies who wanted to shut him up.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.